Hello and welcome to a Culturico podcast episode. I am your host, Alexander Brown, and I'm joined today by Zachary Loeb, a PhD candidate in History and Sociology of Science at the University of Pennsylvania, to talk about the end of the world through computing risk. Hello, Zachary. Glad to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Always looking forward to talking about the upbeat topic of the end of the world with someone.
The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Well, when people think of the end of the world, as I might do now, a lot of things come to mind. Nuclear war, climate change, AI problems, pandemics, natively, and so on. So I'd like to start by asking you, what is it that you specialize in this general point of the end of the world? And why does it matter?
A nice, simple, straightforward, small question to start us off. So to provide a little bit of orientation for the listeners and a bit more for yourself, just in terms of what I work on, I usually describe my research interests as being at the intersection of the history of technology and disaster studies, or the history of disasters. And then within the history of technology, I work specifically on the history of computing. But in terms of where this then connects to the history of disasters and some of the broader issues that undergird a lot of my thinking and interests, I'm really interested in the idea that humanity's romance with technology, specifically with computer technology, is going to lead to the destruction of humanity, the downfall of civilization. And so that's kind of the idea that's in the background of a lot of what I work on and what I'm interested in. And the way that I tend to explore that is by looking at computer-exacerbated risks, computer-exacerbated hazards, and the way in which people, societies, institutions respond to and make sense of these risks and these hazards. But that is the much less exciting way to approach things. That is the much less interesting way than kind of just saying that I'm interested in the end of the world, which is the, I guess, kind of sexier way of talking about what I'm interested in and what I work on. Because when you say you work on computers and risk, that isn't as exciting as saying you are interested in the end of the world. And so taking your starting point of the things you listed, whether it's climate change, pandemics, nuclear war, so forth, what I'm really interested in here and what I think is really important to think about is the difference between the end of the world and the end of the world as we know it. So I don't mean to upset any of your listeners, but the truth of the matter is that the world is going to end. That's going to happen about 7 or 8 billion years from now. And that's going to happen because our sun is going to move through its life cycle. And when it gets to the point where it becomes a red dwarf, it will expand and pretty much destroy the Earth as it expands. And that will be the end of the world. So I'm sorry to have to break that to people who weren't aware of it. But the good news is, you know, that won't happen for 7 or 8 billion years. That's a very long time from now. I have no intention of being around to see it, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't have any concern about such a thing, but 7 or 8 billion years, this is truly an astronomical amount of time. What we tend to talk about what most people are more concerned about when they talk about the end of the world isn't really the end of the world. It's the types of things that you referenced before that bring about the end of the world as we know it. Things that are going to dramatically transform life as we know it, our lifeways as we know it, the world that we have become accustomed to. And these changes can represent lots of different things, whether it's something that changes the climate of the planet, which we are accustomed to, and finds us suddenly living in a world with more intense weather, more natural hazards, resource scarcity as a result of that, whether it's technological shifts, you mentioned AI, that have the potential to drastically destabilize, again, the world as we have kind of grown accustomed to it. You mentioned the pandemic, and I think that many people in the course of the last 3 years in this still ongoing pandemic have found a lot of what they thought they knew about the world they lived in really kind of upended. So the starting point there, to say it again, is to emphasize that when we're talking about the end of the world, what we're almost always really talking about is the end of the world as we know it, the end of the world as people know it, and the end of the world as people and kind of the here and now know it. And if you look throughout history and you look at the various plagues, wars, and other horrible tragedies that are found throughout human history, you can find numerous instances where one or another group of people have experienced the end of the world as they knew it. But that doesn't in and of itself represent the end of the world. And my interest within this, some of what I work on within this, are specifically the ways in which technological changes, specifically those involving computing, have the potential to shift the world as we know it, to uproot the world as we know it, and potentially to bring about the end of that world for good or for bad.
Thanks very much for a complete answer. As you mentioned in your historical academic work and also your popular journalism or blogging online, this technological pessimism or skepticism that you're referring to draws on some very old ideas and also other thinkers of the 20th century who you've looked at. Just for our audience to have a background, could you possibly trace a brief history of these ideas?
Sure. So there is a difference here that I'll also try and get us quickly towards. That's the difference between apocalypticism in general and apocalyptic thinking in general, and then a shift wherein the apocalypse starts being more and more associated with techno-scientific forces of one form or another, with computing then being, you know, a form of those techno-scientific forces. So if you look at the history of religion, if you look at lots of different religions, lots of different cultures throughout time and from many different parts of the world, you'll find evidence in, again, many different cultures of various apocalyptic stories, myths, legends, ideas of at some point or another kind of an end of times. And in a lot of this apocalyptic thinking, a lot of this religiously inclined apocalyptic thinking, this is an end that is brought about by God or gods or forces that are kind of outside of humanity's control. And the shift that I track in my work, and which my work is kind of in the spirit and tradition of, are works that look to these apocalyptic scenarios and these end times scenarios and sees the force that brings about the end not as coming from a god or gods, but comes from humanity itself in one form or another. The idea that humans start meddling with the planet, humans start meddling with various technological forces, and in the process of doing that, humanity kind of brings about its own downfall, its own demise. And These ideas also have a very long history that can be seen in lots and lots of different cultures throughout the world and throughout time. It's not uncommon to see variations of myths that have some version of a story where some figure steals knowledge from the gods and is punished for it, is struck down, is struck low, which, you know, many of these stories are then kind of seen as warnings against pursuing knowledge that shouldn't be pursued, kind of stories that are meant in one way or another, perhaps to keep humanity in its place, to provide a worldview in which there are some things that are unknowable, some things which should be unknowable, but also a sense in which there are powers in the world, powers in the universe that have authority greater than humanity. Now, alongside this, there are also stories and ideas that start to push away from this idea that, you know, it's all being controlled by God or gods. An idea that, no, the natural world isn't some mysterious place governed by God or gods, but that it is a knowable realm and humans can come to know and understand and potentially to be able to control what's going on there. It's a shift where you no longer see something like an earthquake as a result of God's wrath, but you instead start to see an earthquake as a natural hazard that is a result of natural forces, where the earthquake isn't divine retribution, it's just these things happen on the planet. And as you start to see this shift away from thinking that, you know, all of these forces are being controlled by God, you start to see more of an idea that these forces can be known, these forces can be understood, and these forces can be potentially controlled by human beings. And as that really starts to gain power, as that really starts to gain energy, you start to see some people, some thinkers, warning in one way or another that the more that humanity starts meddling with the natural world, the greater there is of a potential that, you know, for all of our confidence that we know what's going on, maybe we don't really, and we're going to screw things up. And two of the works that really come to mind here that kind of are really starting this ball rolling on, you know, what we might want to think of as technological apocalypticism or technological catastrophism. We see them in the middle of the 19th century, you know, the 1850s and 1860s. And I'm thinking primarily here of George Perkins Marsh's book, Man and Nature, and a French book that I'm going to, you'll all have to forgive my horrible American pronunciation here, La Fin du Monde par la Science by Eugène Huszard, which is The End of the World by Science. And in both of those books that come out roughly around the same time, there is a idea put forth and an argument put forth that in all of the attempts to gain mastery over the natural world, that humanity is in one way or another transforming the natural world in ways that are going to have consequences that we don't fully understand. And of those, Huszard especially is a little bit more in line with the thinking that our unthinking pursuit of more and more technological power, our unthinking pursuit of, you know, conquest over the natural world, our belief that we can triumph and control that is going to eventually have very serious consequences for us. And these are ideas that are certainly lurking in the background as we move throughout then the rest of the 19th century into the 20th century. And then as we move into the 20th century and we follow the various technological advances that are being made, and as we move into the period of, you know, World War I, for example, we see more and more of a sense among a lot of people that technology and science are not only a potentially positive and productive force, but potentially an enormously destructive and catastrophic force. You see this in a lot of the writing that comes out of World War I and the experience of World War I, where people are talking about how the technological forces that are unleashed in World War One, whether we're talking about tanks and machine guns or poisoned gas or artillery, there's really a sense in various descriptions of battlefields and stuff that this has transformed the world into something strange and different and horrible, and that the human has become kind of frail and meek in the face of this immense destructive technological power. Now, then in the aftermath of World War One, which, you know, it's always one of those funny things to remember that at the time it was referred to as the war to end all wars by many people. And of course, looking back at it, we know that that certainly wasn't true. But in the immediate aftermath of World War One and the years after it, there are lots of social critics and philosophers and thinkers who really are staking out a position where they say World War One has showed us the absolutely horrible and destructive potential of this technology. And having learned from that horrible experience, we are, of course, now not going to let that happen again. We are going to harness that power for good. Those people, I think, unfortunately, found their hopeful predictions really smashed by World War II. And in World War II, one of the other things that we really see emerge is, of course, atomic bombs, atomic weaponry, which further shifts the idea of technological destructive force to a global scale, especially in the aftermath of World War II, once we talk about stuff like the Cold War and the nuclear arms race, where we're thinking about these weapons of such catastrophic destructive power that in conversations about the power of these weapons, there really is a concern that a world war fought with nuclear weapons wouldn't just be the destruction of this country or that country or the destruction of this or that city, but could represent the destruction of the world. And then, you know, I recognize that I'm kind of going on and on with this, so I'll kind of clip that history off there, but it's this general trajectory of the idea that the apocalyptic power is something that is in the hands of a god, and then the shift to the idea that that apocalyptic destructive power is in the hands of human beings who think they are gods, but who are still just human beings.
Okay, I'm going to link this now with your own main research, which focuses on Y2K. Obviously, we'll all remember the moment when a simple power plant employee triggered the events of Y2K, leading to immense problems with technology across the world. And this was, of course, an episode of The Simpsons, which you mentioned in one of your articles very amusingly. So that's obviously part of a kind of societal reaction, sometimes of comedy, towards Y2K in terms of what didn't happen in the year 2000. So maybe if you could briefly introduce what Y2K is, and then also how would it fit into this historical narrative that you've just traced?
Sure. So Y2K is certainly one of these things that I think many people remember now with a certain sense of laughter, a certain sense of humor about it. Hindsight is always 2020, of course, and it's always easy to look back and laugh at the problems that didn't happen or the things that were solved. And Y2K is at base a problem that came out of the kind of mid-20th century history of computing. Something that I think many people take for granted today in the age of smartphones and cloud storage is that in the early days of computing, I'm talking about the middle of the 20th century here, computer memory was really, really expensive. So anything that you could do to save memory space was going to be very valuable. And so computer programmers working in the 60s and 50s, they started truncating dates, meaning that instead of having a date represented in the computer with four digits, so let's say 1960, they would just use two digits, 6 and 0. And the thing to know about this is that this worked. This worked really well. It saved money. The programs still worked. But it relied on all of these computer systems being able to make the assumption for their various calculations that the century was 19. And again, this worked for all of the various calculations that various computer systems were making. But there's a problem, you know. Eventually, 19 is going to roll over to 20. And then those calculations, they don't function anymore. They don't make sense. And it's going to cause all kinds of problems in various systems. You know, some computer systems are going to run into these errors and they're going to completely shut down. Others are just going to wind up polluting various databases and stuff with all kinds of garbage data, which isn't the end of, you know, it's not a huge problem, but it's not a small problem either. And this is a problem that computer programmers working in the 60s, you know, they know that this problem exists. These are smart people. They know that eventually the 1900s are going to become the 2000s. But there's always this thought, somebody else is going to fix this. This is somebody else's responsibility. We have so many years until this is going to be a problem. Somebody else is going to fix it. Another part of the problem is that people writing code in the 1960s, they didn't necessarily think that the code they were writing in the 60s was still going to be in operation decades later. But so often happens in the world of computers, as so often happens in the world of computer programs, new code gets built on top of it. So this way of representing dates in this kind of truncated form kind of just becomes a standard thing that's present in so many systems over years and years and years. And then eventually you get to the 1990s and time has kind of run out. You know, you can no longer procrastinate and say somebody else is going to fix this. Now it becomes a matter of, okay, we have to fix this, which is kind of the summary of the Y2K problem. Now, I originally was interested in working on Y2K, and I originally wanted to work on it because I was really interested in the apocalyptic narratives around it. The way that a lot of people were really taking a stance that Y2K was going to be the end of the world. That we had become so dependent on all of these computer systems, and that this problem wasn't going to be fixed in time, and it meant that when 1999 became 2000, all of the lights were going to go out and the banks were going to fail and, you know, society as we knew it was going to collapse. And an interest in that narrative is what initially drew me to wanting to work on Y2K. And the longer I spent working on Y2K, and I have written my dissertation on this and I'll be defending that dissertation a little bit less than a month from now, one of the things that became clearer and clearer to me the more work and research I did on Y2K is that so much of this popular narrative around Y2K and the end of the world, what it often overlooks is the very real story of that computer problem and all of the people working within the IT sector who really performed a heroic effort throughout the 1990s getting everything fixed in time. And so my work on Y2K, and this gets back to the earlier questions, is investigating this kind of juxtaposition between, on the one hand, this very real story of a technological problem and a technological vulnerability that requires real work and a real solution, and that involves tons of technical professionals working overtime to fix things. And then the kind of broader public narrative that takes this very real problem and projects all of this apocalyptic anxiety onto it. And the discrepancy between the way that experts within the technical community are talking about the problem, are thinking about the problem, are working on the problem, and then the way that it's getting framed in stuff like Time Magazine, and the way that various, for lack of a more polite way of putting it, kind of fringe people are framing the problem And one of the things that I think is kind of at the core of that juxtaposition is at the core of making sense of kind of that apocalyptic anxiety around it, is that for me, the thing that Y2K really revealed is how reliant life had become by the end of the 20th century on computer systems. The 1990s are certainly a decade where we see the personal computer really, really taking off. It's definitely the decade where the internet really also starts taking off. But if you compare the level of personal computer ownership in 1990 to what it was in 1999, you know, over the course of that decade, a lot more people are starting to use computers at home, at work, and so forth. And it's a decade in which a lot of people are kind of forced to reckon with the ways in which their lives have become dependent on computers, whether they realized it or not. And Y2K kind of revealed that by forcing people to think about the vulnerabilities in their life that were related to their reliance on these computer systems. You know, maybe in 1999, you still didn't have a personal computer, but your bank was certainly reliant on computers, and the gas station was reliant on computers, and telecommunications were reliant on computers, and the delivery of government services was reliant on computers, and I could go on and on and on. So one of the things that Y2K is really kind of pushing to the fore is not just this technical problem at the core of it, but also a bigger recognition that the world as people knew it had changed. And the world as people knew it was now one in which life as they knew it was reliant on their computer systems continuing to work well. And if those computer systems were to suddenly stop working, could have very serious and negative impacts for lots of people in lots of places in the world. So when I talk about Y2K and when I think about it in terms of kind of this broader context of apocalyptic concerns, apocalyptic anxieties around technology, the thing that I'm interested in there is, so what's really the root thing here? What's really going on? What are people so anxious about as the force that brings everything crashing down? And in the case of Y2K, that anxiety really gets bound up with a recognition that life had become dependent on computer systems.
Thanks for a very nice historical dive into your specialty of Y2K. Your work's quite interesting in the sense that you take a historical approach to how people think about the future in terms of technology. And of course, so many of the things we associate with technology today are ubiquitous, never present. So all the questions that I've asked so far about the past, as you see it, and also your own work on Y2K, all these next questions will be about the future. So I was wondering if I would ask you to do a bit of fortune telling yourself. I'll start with this first one. Does computer risk pose a tangible threat to government? And will we end up being run by techno corporations, as in William Gibson novels?
Oh my gosh. So I'm tempted here to say that, you know, I'm a historian. I can tell you what happened. That doesn't mean I can tell you what's going to happen. But I also realize that that's a cheat. And I also recognize that one of the reasons why people are so interested in history is often we feel that by learning from the past, we can have a better understanding of the present and also hopefully feel better informed moving into the future. So I'm going to kind of split your question there into two halves a little bit. So one of the things that you mentioned there, and my apologies if I'm not quoting you exactly, but does computer risk pose a tangible threat to government? And I think that the answer here is a pretty unambiguous yes, it does. Granted, of course, what we mean by this risk is going to vary. I think that if you talk to anybody who works in the cybersecurity field, and there are lots of people who do cybersecurity work for governments and for corporations, they will be able to tell you all about the various computer exacerbated risks that governments and, you know, corporations and individuals are confronting. And many of these are very serious risks. Many of them are very real. The day that you and I are having this discussion, the day before it, there was a hearing in the U.S. Congress about TikTok. And I think that there's been a lot of back and forth and commentary talking about in what ways are the government's concerns about TikTok, you know, and its risks kind of overblown, and what ways are some of these risks there really just the same ones that we see from Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, and it's not so focused just on that. But when we think about the world of cyberspace, when we think about the world of computers and technology there, you know, there certainly are all kinds of risks that they pose to government sources. And some of this gets back to some of my work on Y2K as well, because one of the things that Y2K also was demonstrating about computers is that, especially now, and I mean, this was certainly the case in many nations by the end of the 20th century, computers have kind of become essential infrastructure in our societies. Whether we're talking about the grid or water treatment or telecommunications, or, you know, we could go on and on and on. So many of these services, so many of these functions are themselves entirely dependent on computers, are dependent on computer systems working well. So if those computer systems are damaged, if those computer systems are hacked, if those computer systems are, you know, compromised in one way or another, you know, that presents a very serious risk and danger, not just for a government, but for the people who live in a particular society or country. So in terms of that kind of first question of, you know, is there a tangible threat here? I think that the answer there is definitely yes, there is. And again, you know, then when we go into the conversation of what kind of risk does social media pose to teenagers, you know, that's another conversation that's worth having, but it's kind of, you know, a different one from the one that I'm more interested in, of kind of like this fundamental infrastructural sort of risk. Okay, so now to your second question, which is both more fun and less fun, of are we going to end up living in a world run by kind of unaccountable tech corporations like we see in, you know, various cyberpunk fiction? I definitely have lots of friends who would respond to this by arguing that we already live in a world run by unaccountable tech corporations. That is certainly one view of it. I think that we definitely live in a world in which a lot of tech companies have a lot of power, in which many of these corporations are fairly unaccountable, but I also think that we live in a world in which that power is not unassailable. I'm a big believer in democracy, as idealistic and naive as it may be to say something like that. And I think that people can come together. I think that people can organize. I think that people can push for oversight, for control, for regulation. I think that it's very, very dangerous to get caught up in an idea that this or that technology is inevitable, that this or that technology is, you know, unquestionable. I think that if we look at various pieces of cyberpunk fiction and we find that the world that they portray, where it's kind of this world that has a mixture of ecological collapse and dominance by unaccountable tech corporations, I think that if we see that and we find it scary and unappealing, I will admit I find it scary and unappealing, then I think it behooves us in the present to stand up and do something about it. The technologies we have, the technological systems that are in place, they didn't just happen. they weren't inevitable. The history of technology is filled with other paths that could have been taken. It's filled with contingency, and it is filled with people making decisions. And I think that when we talk about technology and when we think about the technological future, it's important to take some steps away from technology and to think about people, to think about the role of people, to think about what people can do, whether that is in your own life, whether that is organizing in your community, whether that is putting pressure on elected officials. The computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum, who was an early figure in the history of artificial intelligence, who then very clearly made a break with the work being done in artificial intelligence and really became kind of an outspoken critic. One of the things that he talks about in his 1976 book, Computer Power and Human Reason, is this idea that one of the things that the idea of technological inevitability does is it removes the sense of responsibility from people. Because if technology is inevitable, then you have no responsibility to do anything. And that's a really dangerous way to look at it, he argues, and I think he was really right on that, that we don't just have to idly accept the stuff that's offered to us by the Googles and Teslas and Facebooks of the world. You know, we have agency, we can act, we can make decisions. It's not about technology driving history. It's about people. And, you know, we can grab that steering wheel.
I'm glad you mentioned the computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Because I have a quote from him as well, which I'd like to interrogate you on. Which was, it's very similar to my, well, it's very, very similar to my next question. So it was, what limits ought we, the people generally, and scientists and engineers more particularly, to impose on the application of computation to human affairs? So that strikes me as very similar to what we were just talking about. And more specifically, I want to focus on this word limits. Because what I'm seeing, like, lots of very good intentions in terms of control, regulation of mega tech corporations. But can you really envision a future where we actually do use less computing or limited computing, bearing in mind how central it is and how much, how many magnificent bribes, to use Mumford's phrase as well, we've made in terms of, like, allowing technology to enter our lives? Do you think it's really possible that we could use less computing if that was needed at all?
So this is a very big and challenging question, and it's definitely one that occupies a lot of my thinking. Weizenbaum is a figure who is very important for my own thinking. You also mentioned Lewis Mumford, who's also very important there. I think that something that's important to kind of start off with here, and, you know, also referring back to history, is most of human history did not involve computers. I mean, computers are not that old, and computers as we know them are certainly not that old either. So if the question is, can you imagine a society that is less reliant on computers? Well, of course, because we can look back throughout human history, and there are lots of examples of societies in which people lived meaningful lives without computers. That isn't to say that their lives were problem-free. That isn't to say that their lives were utopias. I mean, I'm not trying to give a romanticist view of, oh, if only we could go back to living in a world without computers. I'm not interested in making that kind of argument, but I do think it's worth remembering that most of human history existed without computers. And history in the time period that we do have computers, it's not like we had computers and suddenly all of our problems disappeared. Some of these basic problems of human life, love, happiness, struggle, conflict, these are human problems, and I think that they are going to be with humans for as long as humanity exists. And the idea that this or that technological regime is going to magically solve all of those problems, I think that that's silly. But there is a bigger question here about what is the appropriate role for computers in society? And I think that there is a real question and conversation to have there. And I also think that it's a question and conversation that many people, to a greater or lesser extent, are having. Sometimes they don't necessarily put it in exactly these terms, but, you know, does your coffee maker need to be connected to the internet? Does your washing machine need to be connected to the internet? Is it good to always be online 24/7? I think that these are some of the things that people are wondering about and wrestling with in their lives. And it's not a question of 100% computers or 0% computers. It's a question of, okay, so how much and in what areas? And I think that one of the areas where we're seeing a lot of interesting conversations about this playing out right now are in the areas that deal with some of the various AI art generators that we're seeing, and also some of the new AI chatbots and text generators, where you're seeing people do stuff like, oh, here is a comic book created entirely using AI art. Or I think that already if you go on a website like Amazon, you can find books that were written entirely using like AI text generation. And I think that there's a real conversation worth having about whether or not just because a computer can do something, does it mean that it should? Are there certain areas of life, are there certain things that we really want to say, you know, no, this isn't something that computers should do. No, this is really something that we want to kind of say, this is a human pursuit and humans are going to be the ones doing it. Now, of course, I recognize that I have been using the word we in here, and I am a person who has their own opinions and ideas and thoughts about this. I'm sure that you and your listeners can all tell that I'm a little bit more skeptical about some of these things. But at the same time, I think that it's a conversation that lots of people are having. I think that it's a conversation that is worth having going forward. I think that there are a lot of people who, for the most part, find that they quite like computers and their smartphones and their apps, but who at the same time have some dissatisfaction. At the same time, wonder if everything that Silicon Valley has given us is necessarily a good thing. Have some skepticism about the direction that things are going. And I think that these are conversations that are worth having and that need to be had. And though in my role as a human being, I intend to participate in these conversations, you know, it isn't my place to say one way or another what the decision should be. But I think that as a species, as human beings, it's a conversation that cannot just be delegated to tech companies. Because, you know, on the one hand, I can certainly imagine, and I've had these experiences where somebody will say something along the lines of, well, who are you to say that it should be this way? And that's fair. You know, who am I to say that it should be that way? But who are the people at the tech companies? You know, why is it that they get all of the say? And, you know, you do not. You know, why is it that a couple of people at edtech companies are getting all of the say in the shaping of education, and we don't tend to hear so much from actual students. This is a conversation that involves all of us. This is a conversation that affects all of us, and I think that therefore it is a conversation that all of us need to have a part in, and I think that it's a conversation that we should insist that we all not only have a right, but have an obligation to participate in.
I've reached the end of my allotted questions. However, there is one final one I thought I might ask. It's also from Weizenbaum, who's a fantastic source of questions. And I appreciate you specialize in infrastructural risk mainly, but I just think it's such an important question currently, and it intersects with so many other important points of the sociology of science, especially. So we've been talking about the end of the world, like scenarios that are sort of causing mass panic. But I was thinking also the role of the computer might also have a kind of creeping apocalyptic scenario, kind of like a creeping loss of humanity might be associated with it. So one of Weizenbaum's questions was, what is the impact of the computer on the self-image of human beings and on human dignity? So especially in terms of other things we haven't discussed yet, like algorithmic discrimination, certain technical appliances that work better for the people of certain ethnicities and so on, as has been studied. So I wonder if you have any take on that, and this maybe relates to, maybe as I mentioned, a slightly more under the surface eroding of humanity that people associate with the computer. Do you see anything to this?
So certainly, I definitely think that there's something to this, and I think that this is a little bit of what I was alluding to before when I was talking about stuff like AI systems creating art, creating novels, this idea that there are certain activities that we so closely associate with humanity, or at the very least with kind of living creatures, that what does it mean when we start seeing various computer programs that are generating these things? I definitely think that here it can be very easy to see computer systems, to see artificial intelligence, to see lots of technologies as things that we project our fears and also our hopes onto. And so some of what we look at when we look at these gets a little bit beyond what these machines are actually capable of doing, and kind of very easily jumps ahead from, you know, you look at a computer and right away you think that it's Skynet from Terminator. But at the same time, as your example of algorithmic bias brings up, like, there are very real harms being perpetuated by computer systems right now. You know, that's not a matter of skepticism. You know, there's so much excellent scholarship on this. And by the same token, there's so much excellent scholarship on the way that AI systems so often have, you know, people behind them. And just to kind of quickly throw out three recommendations to people, you know, in terms of looking at the humans behind so much of AI, I recommend checking out the work of Sarah Roberts. In terms of algorithmic inequality, the work by Sophia Noble is absolutely essential. And in terms of some of the ways that some of these systems are already existing and impacting people and impacting some of the most vulnerable people in society, I highly recommend checking out the work of Virginia Eubanks. My apologies, my background in my previous life was I was a librarian, so I tend to have a bit of a default of going into a world where I just recommend books and authors to people. But I think that this question of what do computers mean for our conception of ourselves as people, what do new technologies mean for our conceptions as ourselves as people? It brings us back to what I was saying at the start about the end of the world versus the end of the world as we know it. And one of the things that we're seeing here is that the world as we knew it is changing. And we're finding ourselves having to get our grounding and our footing in a new world as it is becoming known to us. And this is scary and this is disorienting. But it's also a moment in which we can have a role in how things develop, in how things look, in the way that we want to use things, in the way that we want to be used by things. And I would just say that the moments that people have where their interaction with one of these systems leads to that kind of inward discomfort in one way or another, don't overlook those feelings. Like, don't try and like just move on. Like, those are the moments where you really need to think, okay, what is it about this that I find troubling? Why do I find this troubling? And instead of just like swallowing it and not thinking about it and moving on, like, have the courage to like admit that you are anxious, that you are worried, and know that you are also not the only one feeling this way. Like, talk to other people about your concerns, your anxieties, your fears, your hopes. To restate something that I said before, none of these things, despite what you might see in advertisements and despite what you might see on the pedestals of various tech conferences, you know, this stuff isn't inevitable. And the role that you play in it matters, and you can play a role in it.
Well, this seems like an excellent note to end on. So thanks very much, Zachary Loeb. I wish you the best with your upcoming PhD thesis defense.
Thank you.
And thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Culturico was produced by Alexander Brown. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at culturico.com. If the world didn't end and you liked our episode, don't forget to subscribe to Culturico on your podcast player. And last, if you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.